of the House Committee on Land Use. Good afternoon, committee members and our audience. We will open a public hearing. We will not have a work session today on 2618, in that there are numerous people who wanted to speak on this bill who would not be here today, and ask that we put off the work session. So we will do that, have a second public hearing on this bill next Monday, and a work session the following. Okay, so we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2618 and ask Mike McCarthy of Hood River and Cliff Kennedy of Albany to come forward, please. Sam, if you'll read the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2618 is one which will require the Land Conservation Development Commission to essentially to adopt rules which will authorize dwellings in areas for exclusive farm use that would take into consideration unique characteristics associated with the property. That could be soil class, it could be property size, and other factors around the property. Currently, you may be aware that in exclusive farm use lands, there would be an income threshold test and a minimum lot size threshold plus $30,000, typically and the minimum lot size can be 40, 80 acres, 40 or 80 or on the eastern side larger. And this would only pertain to farm dwellings that would have difficulty meeting the minimum income test. It would not does not pertain to non-farm dwellings, which would be a separate category. And that would be essentially the measure that you have before you.
Okay, thank you, Sam. Mike, would you like to start off, please?
Sure, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, especially for letting us testify, since there really wasn't officially going to be a hearing, I guess, but it was postponed. I oppose House Bill 2618. I'm a farmer from Parkdale, Oregon. Before you start going off in all directions with bills, I'd like to see you try to deal with Measure 37. I think that's important. We know it's a big issue. Before I talk too much about specifically about House Bill 2618, I want to talk a little bit about the whole issue of additional dwellings in the farm zone. And partly this is in response to a question that Representative Smith asked me in Hood River, which I gave her a very poor answer to. Really wasn't prepared to answer it, but she asked me what problems I've encountered from non-farm dwellings near my farm and other dwellings near my farm, whether it be a subdivision or what you might call a ranchette or rural residential. It took me a while to kind of go through my memory and come up with some of them. The one thing that I will say about the problems I've had is it takes a lot of my time as a farmer, and I'd rather be farming than being a police officer or security. And I spend a lot of time doing that, spend a lot of time dealing with the local police, trying to figure out a way to remedy some of these problems that I have with non-farm neighbors. One of the comments that was made at the hearing by the Senate in Hood River from another grower was that he'd never heard of any problems and hadn't had any problems. And I just want to make sure it goes into the record that there are problems that affect farmers that are trying to make a living and we're trying to make a profit. We're small business owners, and this takes away from our time trying to farm.
Mr. Kennedy, could you enumerate
Mr. McCarthy?
Mr. McCarthy, the kind of problems that you would have to call the police on.
Yes, definitely. And the one thing I wanted to say, these aren't things I made up. You know, like I said in the hearing in Hood River, people said that there weren't problems and people complain about it, but they really don't exist. These are all documented in the Hood River County Courthouse in the Sheriff's Department records. These are all things that I would not be protected for by right to farm. Right to farm would not help me a bit on these things. These are things that have been out-of-pocket costs. The first one I remember is one time I was out spraying in my orchard, and I looked at a bunch of young trees that I planted, and most of them were way shorter than I remembered them to be. Some of them only a foot high, and I got off the sprayer and started looking around, and they'd been butchered. And I thought, the first thought, well, bear, deer, what the heck was it? Well, I got to look, and they'd all been hacked down with a machete, and there were about 60 trees, pear trees, about 3 years old, ready to start producing a little fruit probably in the next season. I called the sheriff, had them come out. They made me fill out a report. Another sheriff came out later, took a look around. They spent probably a day or two of my time filling out reports, trying to figure out what happened. Contacted the county extension agent because the sheriff's department wanted an estimate of the damages, and the county extension agent came out and did a calculation. And part of the thing you got to realize about a crop like fruit trees is if you damage a tree that's 3 years old and you have to plant a new one, that means at the other end, 10 years from now, you lost 3 years worth of production. And so the extension agent was able to figure that in, calculated the damages at about $1,200. The matter went to court. They found in favor of me and supposedly awarded me some damages. Then they had a discussion with the people that had done the damage. They had no money, and I got no damages, no money at all for that.
Who were the people, Mr. McCarthy?
They were a neighbor that on what I would call a ranchette next door.
Okay.
Another one that I had is I planted a young orchard about 100 feet from a neighbor's house. This I'd call this a ranchette also. Planted a young orchard about 100 feet from the house. The guy decided that he really didn't want an orchard out there, and he went out and sprayed him with Roundup. And again, in this case, I called the ODA. I talked to the sheriff. They said, call the ODA. This is a violation of a pesticide application. You can't apply pesticide to somebody else's tree. That's a violation of the label. I called the ODA, had a long discussion with them, and they said it'd be pretty impossible to find out who actually did it. And after several discussions with them, we dropped that one. We figured the damages in at about $1,000. And again, it didn't cover any of my time. Another one that I had happen, and this is just the last one I'll probably give you. Somebody in a four-wheeler was driving around my orchard one day when I wasn't there. They ran over an irrigation line, but the irrigation line, it was the pipe right next to the valve. And when they drove over it, they broke the valve off. And the kid, rather than coming and finding somebody or trying to turn off the system, he left the water running all night and got the heck out of there. Well, when we went out, my foreman went out in the morning, he gave me a call and said, well, your road's gone. And I said, what the heck? And he said, somebody broke a pipe, and the water ran down the road all night and made about a 3-foot gully in it. And that one also went to court, went to the police, filled out all the reports, did all that stuff. They said they'd fix it. The family said they'd fix it. We found out who did it. My foreman had seen a four-wheeler there the day before, and so we went and contacted them. The sheriff's contacted them, and we had a discussion with them. They said they'd repair the damages. They said they'd get somebody in there with a dump truck and a grader to fix it. After about a week, we gave up waiting. Nobody showed up. I went and talked to them. I talked to the sheriff. The family told me that the father was dying of cancer and they didn't have any money. They said the kid would work it off. I took him and gave him a project to do, and he worked a little bit, and then I couldn't wait around there and work with him all day, and he really didn't want to work, and he went home and said he'd come back another time, and I gave up on it because really it was just spending a lot of my time. So those are three pretty good examples, and those are all adjacent dwellings in the farm zone. And another one was somebody backed their car up and started filling it up, the trunk of their car up with apples one time. And I caught them doing it, and they said, well, you've got a lot of them. You only miss a couple hundred pounds. Talked to their dad. He said the kid would make good on it or pay me back or something, and I never heard anything about that. Might be able to get some money out of these things if I spent full time on it. You know, if I spent all day every day. But I want a farm, and I don't want any more of these non-farm dwellings next to me. And to me, a non-farm dwelling is something that where they're not really farming to make a living. It just seems like my experience, people that are farming to make a living, they know what you're doing, and they don't mess with it. And their kids don't mess with it either. And people that are just kind of hobby farming, and people that wouldn't meet the income test, of trouble, and they've been trouble for me. And so this isn't something that some of us just imagine to make up a story and come down here. This is people violating my personal property rights. And I think it's important that you think about that, whether it's Measure 37 you're talking about or whether it's this bill. My property rights are getting violated, and all I'm trying to do is farm. And I hope you'll consider that. I was on the original committee that studied the $80,000 test. I know it's a controversial item, but we studied 100 different options, permutations, methods of trying to determine who actually wants to be out in the farm zone, working in the farm zone. And the only thing that we could come up with that was really objective was a specific dollar test, actual dollars. $80,000 to me this year is about 10 acres. That's 10 acres of farming for me to make the $80,000 test. So is this some huge, tremendous test that people can't meet that's just insurmountable? It's a paltry sum for the average farmer. And I'm the average farmer. I'm not a big grower. I'm not a small grower. I'm kind of the average farmer. And $80,000 is 10, 11, 12 acres maybe. So some other test that you're going to create, I don't think it'll be workable. Every county will do it different. Every county will administer it differently. Every individual that applies for it, depending on their skill level and the number of consultants that they hire, will approach it differently. And I don't think it's a workable solution. So I hope you take these into consideration. And again, I really appreciate you allowing me to testify today.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and we appreciate the fact that you drove 100 miles thereabouts to be here today.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Greenwood.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mike, thank you for coming. I do want to note for the record that the other end of his family, his brother, is my constituent, so I hear the story from the Clear Creek distillery side as well. You live in the Hood River Valley, and I live my district includes very fertile lands in Washington County, and I drive through Yamhill County and other of the valley, the very fertile valleys around, and I hear your story. But there's also land, lots of other places where people do a little farming, and you know, I have some land in Cook County where I don't see how anybody ever make $80,000 a year on anything out there with the sagebrush and juniper. How would you still say that this kind of thing applies for sort of what's exclusive farm use in places that don't seem very farm friendly?
Well, I'd answer that a couple of ways. I think generally this $80,000 test is to apply to high-value farmland, I believe. And I think that's a good way to segregate them out. I think in the case of high-value farmland, it's not impossible to make that test. And certainly you can't do it on the same number of acres I can in Hood River County. But if you're going to really be a farmer, you've got to make $80,000 if you're even half serious about it. So you have to do it on a little different scale. You got to do it on the 80-acre scale, which to me means that it's even more critical not to put more houses in the farm zone, because the farmer, in order to have an economic unit, has to have more acres. So that's how I'd answer that.
If I may continue, sir. The bill we have in front of us talks about EFU land, and it suggests in that there be an EFU land, the other things taken into consideration, including soil class and things like that. I mean, I don't know whether this is just opening the door, and that's what we're in, but I mean, sometimes my impression is, and I'm not the agricultural expert, you are, but there's a lot of EFU land around the state that's not really Category 1, is that the term?
Well, like 1 or 2 generally considered high value. But
I mean,
I think it's possible in some conditions, but the problem is, are we going to make it arbitrary and every county is going to decide? And basically open the door to whatever the county decides. I don't think that's the way to approach it. I think they have to be very good statewide standards that allow the best to be kept without additional houses. Now, I hope you're able to figure out the way to do that, but I think to open the door is a serious problem to commercial agriculture.
McCarthy, I can introduce you to about 1,000 farmers in Klamath who will disagree with you on their EFU land producing $80,000 a year. There's a whole bunch of people in Eastern Oregon that aren't making $80,000 a year, and they may have 100 acres. May I ask how big your acreage is in Hood River?
I farm, the land that I own that I farm is about 110 acres. Yeah.
Any other questions of Mr. McCarthy? Thank you again for making the trip. We appreciate it. Mr. Kennedy.
I am Cliff Kennedy, retired farmer from Benton County. I oppose House Bill 2618 as it would destroy the only effective tool we've had to separate production farmers from hobby farmers. Its effectiveness is attested to by the volume of resistance from those who are not committed to farming, but mostly want a home in the country. At times, this includes some token farming. Oregon has around 200,000 acres in rural residential where these folks can do their thing without causing conflicts with adjoining production agriculture. On pages 3 and 4, I have listed some of the people conflicts I've experienced over 40 years of farming. My son Peter is continuing the operation of Kennedy Family Farm. On page 2, I have a chart that shows the average gross income and the average net income in Oregon farms during 1997 as per the 97 Census of Agriculture. The third column on the right demonstrates why Oregon hobby farmers cannot qualify under the $80,000 gross income test. The average hobby farmer grosses only $2,730 while going in the hole with a net loss of $3,200. This group racked up an accumulated net loss of $6.3 million. The center column shows that the production farmers of Oregon gross on the average $223,000, well over the $80,000 gross income test. In fact, their average net income of $63,000 almost makes the test itself. Some folks contend that they need a farmhouse in the country to get started farming. In my little 3 years, I have not seen anyone, not one, gain entry into farming by first building a home in the country. I lived my first 10 years of farming in Albany on 4th Street. An aspiring potential farmer will invest his first resources to rent land, buy equipment, seed, and fertilizer. Please kill this bill. On page 2 is the chart I have. I enjoy learning how to make charts, but I haven't really learned how to use them in a hearing like this. So if you want to spend a little extra time yourself on that and get a bird's eye picture of what I just told you on page 1, I'd appreciate it. I've also put together some conflicts I've experienced over the 40 years. These first 6 conflicts are complaints I've gotten from my neighbors. Now, these complaints would, you could argue, be addressed by the Right to Farm Bill. The next 14 complaints could not be. Neighbors' complaints. Number 1, bees. Neighbors complained that the bees in the adjoining field for pollination purposes were drinking from their water faucet. Number 2.
Yes, the first time I found a newly rented 45-acre field, I began at bedtime. A neighbor protested vehemently that he had lived there for years and never before had he been subject to such noise while trying to sleep. My 10-minute trip around the field would give time for him to get to sleep, and then comes the tractor again to waken him. I volunteered to work the far half of the field first, but I would probably be back to the house again before he got up in the morning. Number 3, a wedding request. A neighbor requested that we not harvest our wheat on a Saturday when they were having a wedding. Fine, we could work around that. However, if the crop had been beans or corn, we would have had to comply with the processor's schedule. Number four, dust. I was often so vulnerable that I carefully coordinated the rototilling of my strawberries with irrigation to avoid dusty conditions. I don't recall ever getting a dust complaint, but I do remember inconveniencing myself to lean over backwards to avoid making dust. Noise. We had so many noise complaints from harvesting corn or beans at night that we learned to leave the phone off the hook. Number six, irrigation. After 10 houses went in alongside one field, it seemed that I could never irrigate without getting a complaint about water coming across the fence. I even got a letter from one's attorney. I couldn't figure out who they complained to when it rained. I finally spent $600 for special sprinklers. Okay, now my complaints that would not be amenable with the right to farm bill, right to farm law, or whatever. Number one, two irrigation center pivots flattened by rifle shots. I vaguely recall we reported to this, back to the police, but nothing ever got done. Number two, irrigation pipe punctured by rifle shots. Irrigation electric meter ruined by rifle shots. Irrigation pump sustained minor damage by rifle shots. Number five, irrigation pipe damaged by cars driving where they shouldn't have been. One time the offender voluntarily paid for a new pipe, but I didn't charge him for the inconvenience of having to take care of it. Number six, puppy in the ditch. Now this is a real serious one. Somebody could have gotten hurt. In the late 70s, we dug a 2,000-foot trench 4 feet deep through the middle of a 90-acre field, parallel with and 900 feet from a county road and three non-farm duplexes. This was to bury permanent irrigation pipe. We had problems with the trench wall sloughing off, so the trench was left exposed for several days while we did corrective backhoe work. 20 years later, the person waiting on me in a local business recognized my name and told me how when he was a boy he was my neighbor. He asked, what was that ditch about? One night he heard of his puppy barking and found him in that ditch. He said it wasn't easy to get it out. That was an eye-opener for me. It hadn't occurred to me that a trench that isolated would be a hazard to neighbor kids. He and his puppy could have been buried alive by additional dirt sloughing off. Corn saved from, number seven, corn saved from myself was hijacked for the neighbor's rabbits. At the end of commercial corn harvest, I generally left 40 feet of row standing so we could have a few more meals of roasting before winter set in. One year when I returned from my corn, a neighbor had picked all of it for his rabbits. Number eight, cranky soil dispelled over the fence onto my land. One day I noticed some cranky soil dumped 4 feet over onto my side of the fence. Inquiry revealed that the neighbor's grandson had done it. She had him clean it up. I could only hope that they got it all. Number nine, dog droppings. The fence line by my strawberry field had a nice shade tree where my hoes would sit to eat their lunch. One day they complained that the neighbor had thrown her accumulated dog droppings all across the fence where they always sat. The neighbor's response to my confrontation was, I don't want my toddler playing in that stuff. I scooped up several boxes full and placed the boxes on her side of the fence. Number 10, neighbor's picking beans. One day we were driving down the road, I noticed several women in the bean field. It appeared as if they were picking beans. I walked out to where they were, and sure enough, they each had a pan of beans. My question to them was, what am I to think about this? One responded, the realtor who sold them their houses told them that the first two rows along the side of the field are always for the neighbors. They ended up climbing back across the fence, taking the pans of beans with them. No, they did not offer to pay for the beans. Number 11, kids eating strawberries. One fall when we had an unusually good crop of off-season strawberries, I was aware that the neighbor kids were coming in from the backside of the field and obviously enjoying the berries. This was a dilemma for me. Not that they could eat enough berries to hurt me, But rather, it was the recommended time of year to apply a pesticide for slugs. If I would have applied the pesticide and one of the kids had gotten the runs from eating too many berries, I would have been at risk of being accused of poisoning a kid with pesticide. Aerial spraying hazard. One year I grew a crop for a processor who assumed responsibility for applying any needed pesticides. This crop was planted across the road from three duplexes. I happened to come along when they were applying a very hazardous chemical by airplane. I watched him swoop down low. He appeared to be doing a good job as he headed for the duplexes with the chlorine chemical clearly visible. As he approached the road and the duplexes, the chemicals were shut off and the plane climbed and circled for another pass. Though the pilot appeared to execute his maneuvers with precision, I told myself, never again will I plant a crop in that field that requires an application of a hazardous chemical. In another time and place, I had observed incontrovertible evidence that a herbicide was not effectively shut off until 60 feet beyond the state highway. 13. Kids on haystacks. One time when I had baled the alfalfa hay stack near the road for convenience in selling, I chanced to see three pre-teenagers playing on the stack and pushing the bales off the top. They were having a ball. I rushed to the scene as fast as my pickup could safely take me. By the time I arrived, the stack had tumbled, and one kid was buried up to his chin in bales. His buddies were frantically trying to free him. I was so scared I didn't even get angry. Had one of those kids been seriously hurt, I could have been sued for having an attractive nuisance. Number 14, spraying hedge. Since my retirement, my son Peter used a native species found on our farm to establish a hedgerow on our side of the fence line by the 10 houses. Several neighbors spread them out by their place. This species bill was about 5 or 6 feet tall. Very nice. Please note that the seriousness of some of these conflicts complaints are right down hazard. Thank you.
Any questions, committee, or Mr. Committee? Thank you, sir. You have the makings here for a good movie.
Come on.
Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, we will continue this public hearing on Monday, but if there is anyone else, Don, if you want to come up and give testimony now, it'll save you a trip back here next Monday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. When I wrote you the note, I thought about stopping at the point where I asked you to put me on your list, but I figured you were already there, or I was already there.
Oh, you are indeed.
Yes. I figured that to be the case. Anyway, nevertheless, I'm Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The current purpose of the bill is to allow more farm dwellings on high-value farmland. Remind you that high-value farmland is only about 25% of the land in EFU zones. Not to forget the changes that we've made recently in farm dwelling criteria. It's not like $80,000 is the only way you can put a farm dwelling in high-value farmland. Number one, there's a relative dwelling. If you have a relative who's going to be involved in farming activity, they can automatically put a house on the farmland. Has to be on the same parcel that your house is located on, or the primary dwelling is located on, but it can be done. There was another problem earlier where the bank said, well, they wouldn't loan money on that. We changed the law so that, in fact, they can loan money on that, and if there's a default, they do have the ability to sell that home site, the bank does, to recover their costs. So we made that change. The $80,000 test on high-value farmland is not inflationary. It used to be. It said $80,000 in 1994 dollars. We removed that inflationary figure so that it's simply $80,000 in today's money, whatever today's money is. So it's actually easier now to put a dwelling on high-value farmland. Also, the $80,000 applies to the income of the entire farm operation in the same ownership. It used to be that the $80,000 applied to the individual parcel. That's no longer the case. You can combine the income of all parcels in the same farm operation, whether they're contiguous or not, and use the income from how many ever those parcels you need. Let's say you have three parcels, but only takes two parcels to meet the 80,000. Then the other parcel is still available to site a dwelling at any other time that it by itself could gross 80,000, but you've used two parcels. So it's not nearly as hard to establish a farm dwelling on high value farmland as it used to be. The income test is a gross income test, gross dollar figure, not a net dollar figure. And as far as Klamath County goes, Mr. Chairman, probably most of the land in Klamath County wouldn't be subject to the $80,000 test, because most of it is probably other than high value farmland, which has three options for a farm dwelling. One being, if it's 160 acres or more, you automatically qualify for a dwelling. The other being, it's a $40,000 income test, or not only can it be a $40,000, if the median income of that the farmland in that county is less than 40,000, it can be less than that. I'm thinking like in, let me say, Wheeler County, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $23,000 to $28,000 gross income, and you qualify for a farm dwelling. Kind of what this bill speaks to, a third option in some counties, all counties haven't adopted this, but in some counties is kind of a what I call a comparability test, where you compare the parcel in which you want to place your dwelling with all other parcels within 1 mile of where you want to put your dwelling. And if your parcel is the same size or larger, and your parcel is capable of producing the same gross income or more than those others, then you also qualify for a farm dwelling. But that's only applicable on other than high-value farmland. High-value farmland is our best farmland, and therefore it's worth protecting to a greater extent than is the lower value farmland. Another concern we have is every dwelling sited on a parcel makes it next to impossible for another farmer to ever buy that parcel, because now you have a dwelling on it that may be at least as much, or maybe twice the value of what the land itself is. But in order to get that land and add it to your operation, you have to buy the house. And so it just puts many parcels out of reach for adjoining landowners. Rather than make this particular change, we would support the committee paying attention and supporting the 30-year review that's been talked about. There may be, we're not saying there can't be changes that could be made, but I think it would be best to make those changes in the context of the 30-year review rather than doing this as an individual bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Don, I got one. Well, part of what this bill says, the DLCD would have to take into consideration, quote, the capability of the lot or parcel. How would you do that? Just using the numbers, the gross and the net on average farmland?
Mr. Chairman, it is a little vague, but I guess I would suggest at this point is, in fact, the income test does do that. It determines what the capability is on a dollar basis. I suppose you could use a production basis of product, but there, you know, with the varied amounts of products that you can use, which one would you use? How would you compare it? So the language there is, you know, pretty wide open, you know, kind of fuzzy. I don't know how you want to look at it, but I don't know. It leave it up to DLCD, I guess, to interpret that. They might get something worse than what they have now. I don't know. Or more complicated, even.
Any other questions for now? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir. And I suppose I can address this with the proposers on Monday, but Where is the 80,000 test inscribed?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, like it is in the administrative rules and LCDC's administrative rules, and I can't cite the number for you. I almost could, but I won't because I'll probably be wrong. But that's where it's at.
Administrative rules pursuant to two different statutes here, as I understand it.
Mr. Chairman.
215 statutes and, I guess they're both 215.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, there's two different statutes because 215, 213 only deals with the marginal lands counties. That's the rules for marginal lands counties. That's Lane and Washington counties. And 215, 283 deals with all other counties. So that's why it's listed in both places in the statute. So that's why the suggested change shows up in both places. Is that your question?
Well, it is. It looks like both Section 1 and Section 2 are amended, and they both relate to 213. But if I may follow just a bit, how does this change, I'm trying to understand this bill, and how do these rules change the requirement for the 80,000? I'm not understanding how this will direct the LCB to do something different, and perhaps this is best to wait till.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, what it does right now, the only option in other ones I've listed for you, the only option regarding 80,000 on high value farmland is the income test. Other than the relative dwelling that I talked about. That's the only option. What this says that you should look at other things also. Now, I'm not the author of the bill, so I don't know what they have in mind there.
I wonder if our administrator has I don't see anything in here that right now says the 80,000 is the only one. It's just the only one they've adopted, it seems to me. Is that?
Well, and that's specifically going to be found in Oregon Administrative Rules 660, I think, -33, et cetera, that's going to specify the income test that they've been referring to. It's not found in state statutes.
So they could change that right now.
Right, and essentially with that provision, as I understand it, and we don't have the requesters here, so we'll probably need more on Monday, but my understanding of reading that is that if this was adopted, they're directing the LCD to adopt new rules that could then take into consideration the things that are involved there.
Well, it just says when establishing new rules.
Well, right, it doesn't specify what that would be, the dollar threshold then would be.
I'll wait till next week.
Mr. Chairman, one other maybe help along that line, where does it come from? What the statutes say is that a farm dwelling is permitted in conjunction with farm use. Well, what does in conjunction with farm use mean? And the site that the committee administrator mentioned there, LCDC defined what in conjunction with farming means, and it means the current farm dwelling criteria that's in that administrative rule.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, John.
We're going to close, Mr. Chairman. We'll close the public hearing on the House Bill 2618, and again, we will continue it next Monday. And we thank those who traveled to give testimony today. Okay, we will have an informational meeting now. We'll call up Stephen Kafori and the Oregon Chapter of the American Planning Association. By the way, committee, just as a point of interest, we have added Senate Bill 348 to Wednesday's schedule, and that was done just this afternoon. 348 is the Dorothy English bill, just for your information. Stephen, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Gaffori. I'm here today representing the Oregon Chapter of the American Planning Association. I have felt somewhat awkward number of times when this committee has asked me hard questions I've had to answer, I don't know, I'm not a planner, I'm just a lobbyist. I thought it might be a good idea if I would bring my clients so you can see who it is that I represent and a little bit about their backgrounds and a little bit about what planners do. We've been talking a lot about the end results of planning and how planning may or may not be changed, but I think it might be a good idea for you to have an opportunity to meet some of the people who do that planning, work with the process. And I urge you to ask some hard questions like you've asked me. So please, a lot of times I've noticed, as I've been around this building, that in this area and in lots of other areas, there are often things to say, that's really simple. Why can't we just change this and everything would be straightened out? Yeah. And if we take a look at the people who actually do this stuff on an ongoing basis, we find the history is such that somebody looked at this 20 years ago and found out, you know, it isn't that simple. And here's what's going on since then. Or, yeah, you're right. Things have developed over a period of years, and the question's different now than it was 20 years ago. So I ask you to ask some questions to these folks after they give their presentations and see if we can get a little idea better about what planners do and what planning is about. I've brought together a person from the city of Portland, so we have an urban planner, a person from Wayne County who is a private practicing land use consultant, and a person who is a commissioner from Jackson County. So we get three different viewpoints.
There's practically few bills that come before this committee that don't somehow impact planning. So we're looking forward to your presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Clay. I'm president of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. With me today are Philip Farrington at my far right. Philip is the vice president of the chapter. And Reeve Hinion from Jackson County is a planning commissioner and also a member of the board. So we decided we would have three board members of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association here to talk to you today. We didn't prepare any specific testimony. We do have a number of handouts, though, and I will tick those off. Those are things that you can take with you and to remind you of what our organization is and the kinds of resources that we have and can offer the committee and individual members. One of the things I brought with me, and I left them with Lindsay Lucky, is a copy of a summary of legislative and policy positions of the Oregon chapter. In here, we have identified what our mission statement is and identified a number of what we think are higher priority issues for planners throughout the state and planning issues that face Oregonians. Let me just quickly tick them off. Transportation and other infrastructure funding, sustainable development initiatives, citizen involvement, housing, improvements to the statewide land use planning system, resource preservation, adequate funding for planning, takings issue related to Measure 37, obviously, economic development and the urban land supply, and watershed health. And also on here is a list of the mission of the chapter. Obviously, it's to forward excellence in planning and the practice of planning, to carry forth a series of objectives. We're a professional organization, an educational organization. We're a 501c3 organization. We have a committee structure that provides a series of workshops and conferences around planning issues to further the profession. We have also offer once or twice a year exam preparation for an exam called the American Institute of Certified Planners. This is a national exam that's administered for planners throughout the state, and approximately 40 to 50% of our OAPA members have passed the exam on our AICP certified members. The Oregon chapter has really a very diverse set of planners. As you probably know, planners are land use planners typically thought of. There's those that do what we sometimes refer to as current planning work or land use case review, and other planners, these are primarily, again, in the public sector that do long-range planning. We have a lot of our membership who does very specific functional planning activities, such as in capital facilities, public infrastructure, housing, parks, economic development, and the like. projects, so there's a whole series of specialty planning activities as well. Urban design is another one. So that's a little bit of an overview of what our organization is and what we do. I also brought a couple of other handouts. One is an article from our last newsletter, and our newsletter looks like this. We have a newsletter that goes out six times a year to our membership. Our membership is about 925 planners throughout the state. Our newsletter goes to over 1,000 individuals who subscribe to the newsletter. I brought with me one of the excerpts from one of our more recent newsletters, and it's titled, "It is Time to Reengage Oregonians in Land Use Planning." And it was an article that was written and prepared by Arnold Kogan, one of our more senior members, and Nohad Toulon, Dr. Toulon, PhD, and a longtime member of the faculty of Portland State University. They talk about a report that was prepared by our chapter back in 2001 that called for a series of changes to the system and a series of recommendations to the statewide planning program. This was about a 25-30 page report in which we reported on the results of a series of interviews with members throughout the profession, both members who are part of our organization as well as those outside, to get their views about things that are either being done right or need some help and need some additional work. And so we made put this report together, made it available to the last administration, and unfortunately, I'm afraid it did not get a lot of attention at the time, and nonetheless, is still available, and I think it still has a lot of kernel of wisdom to it about some of the directions that a lot of us working in the field feel we need to do. So I would commend this article. It's only two pages long to you, and I also brought a copy of the executive summary of a 30-page report also for Lindsay. Lindsay has it available as well that details more specifically what those recommendations look like. But we had identified the problems associated with fairness and equity in the land use planning system and a number of other issues that we thought were really important that were coming to the fore that we thought needed to be addressed. Let me turn to a little bit and tell you a little bit what planners do. Planners are not architects. Planners are not engineers. We're not landscape architects. We like to think of ourselves sometimes as the glue that works with a lot of other professionals that puts together plans and makes a series of recommendations to the city planning commissions and county councils and then on to the city councils and boards of commissioners that offer alternatives and options and series of recommendations. So we think it's our job to try to put together a lot of information from other professionals in the development community to make that kind of information and data available through analysis. And so we work very closely with our allied professions in being able to do that. I mentioned to you a distinction in the public sector between long-range planners and individual case planners. Case planners work with the development community. They work with individual property owners about everything from doing a simple deck addition to a remodel to setbacks to height, to floor area ratios and the like, on up to commercial and industrial buildings and development, very complex series of development activities. Long-range planners, on the other hand, usually are looking at a community-wide set of activities, either at the neighborhood scale, an area-wide scale, or the entire community. Also work on a series of functional areas, and I mentioned parks and public facilities and the like. Planners have a series of skill sets that if you were to pick up any job description, you'd see a range of maybe anywhere from 20 to 30 different skill sets that planners have. I won't go into those details now. I wanted to talk a little bit and let my colleagues spend a little bit of time talking to you about some activities that we have engaged in throughout the state that relate to economic development. I know that some of the impetus behind my own interest in planning probably started when I was 7 years old, and I remember my mom waking me up early one winter morning telling me to put on my rubber boots. And it was really early in the morning, and I had no idea why she was telling me to put on my rubber boots. And I started to get up out of bed, and I looked down, and there were my rubber boots. They were already there. And I got in them, I walked into the living room, and I noticed that there was brown water coming through the front door. And I thought, oh my gosh, what is happening? And my parents were scrambling around, putting all the household goods up on high ground as much as possible. And that created quite a disruption in our lives for the next 3-4 weeks and much longer. The long and the short of it is our home was being flooded. We were part of a large new community that was developing with a series of subdivisions, and we were told later by the Army Corps of Engineers not to worry. This was a 100-year flood event. That means it's a one-time event in your life, and you can't expect to see this happen again. Well, I could see some of you begin to smirk. Yes, it happened to us again 2 years later, and we repeated the cycle all over again. Now I was 9 years old, and my rubber boots were two sizes larger, and I could hold my sister's hand and walk her through the muck. The Army Corps of Engineers finally acknowledged that, yeah, okay, we were wrong. There was too much concrete, there was too much asphalt, there were too many driveways, too many streets, too many rooftops, and so the stormwater only had one place to go, and that was straight onto the hard surface and directly into the creek. And the creek, as you imagine, now twice overflowed. Well, the solution that the Army Corps of Engineers came up with was one that was at least as worse as the flooding in the community. This was all of our neighbors, literally hundreds, if not a couple of thousand homes, was that we would now turn the creek into a canal. So we made a conduit for the creek, and we fenced the creek. All the vegetation was removed, all the trees were removed along that creek so that we can convey the water and allow the urban runoff to continue to occur. So the long and the short of it is, I think you would know what the moral of the story is, that long-range planning can make a difference if we anticipate and think ahead. And today I think we have fewer and fewer of these sorts of catastrophes, if you will. They still happen occasionally, but when we're looking at new communities on the edge of our urban growth boundaries, frequently these are areas that weren't developed in the first place for good reason. Lots of them are filled with creeks. They have wet runs. They have steep slopes. They have upland areas, lots of trees. So it's incumbent upon us today to be able to plan in these areas and still plan for not only residential development, but commercial and industrial development. And I brought along three examples with me today. One is from the city of Gresham, an area that was added to the urban growth boundary. It's called the new Eastside Region 2040 Center. Metro, as you know, has a 2040 concept plan, or maybe you've heard about it. It's for the entire region, for the entire regional urban growth boundary that comprises 25 cities and 3 counties. And a new area east of Gresham has been targeted for additional industrial development. And we think it's a good example of the community coming together with area property owners to begin to plan that area for job creation and economic development opportunities. And again, it's also an area of some steep slopes, some wetlands, and some creeks. Another example that I'm familiar with that I worked on is in a small area just south of Gresham and east of Portland, north of the Damascus boring area, north of Clackamas County, if you're familiar with that area. It's an area of about 1,500 acres, and planning is occurring there that would knit together a new community that would include residential development, homes for about 5,000 new residents, about 5,000 new jobs, and all done in an environment that also includes creeks and wetlands and upland habitat. The Damascus area is another example where the same kinds of long-range planning are occurring literally as we speak today. So those are three examples. There's also the South Waterfront area in the southern end of the central city in Portland that is being planned for 10,000 jobs in conjunction with the Oregon Health Sciences University. That you've heard about the tram probably coming down from the Health Sciences University from the hill all the way down to the base of Ross Island Bridge. Additional 3,000 housing units to occur there, together with commercial office and retail. So a lot of the planning that is now occurring today, unlike when I was a kid growing up in post-World War II subdivision, is really trying to knit together all these elements and knit together them back together in communities to create community. And I think that's some of the lessons that we've learned over the last 20, 30 years. And I think it's something that we're particularly proud of, where I think we have the system in Oregon. Yes, maybe we have some problems and some areas that we need to improve, but we have a comprehensive planning system that's by and large served the state well. So I'll stop there and let Philip tell you a little bit more about what private sector planners do.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Bob. I know you're not here representing the City Planning Bureau, but I do want to put on the record my sympathy with a terrible tragedy that your department incurred last week, and my personal best wishes for your group as they heal from.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, Mr. Greenlee is referring to a suicide accident that we had in the Bureau, and I appreciate those comments very much. Thank you.
Quite sure you can add the sentiments of the entire committee in that regard, so
thank you.
Steve?
Yeah, my name is Philip Harrington. I'm the Vice President and President-elect of Oregon APA. I actually work as the Director of Land Use Planning and Development for Peace Health. Before that, I had worked in the private sector as a land use planning consultant, and prior to that, I actually worked in the public sector for a couple of different agencies. As a private sector consultant, though, I can tell you that, you know, our work isn't just simply to represent those that create the muck that Bob described earlier, but actually to serve as a facilitator to make sure those very conditions don't occur, and to represent our clients, be they public sector and private sector clients and nonprofit clients as well. As a consultant, I had worked on a number of different projects that have a variety of different benefits to communities at large. And as a planner, it's our CODA that we do work in the public interest first, and then we represent the best interests of our constituents, our customers, our clients within that framework. As a certified planner, I also ascribe to a code of ethics that we're obligated to adhere to as well to that effect. As a consultant, though, I've done a number of different projects for clients large and small, mom and pop and large developers, for universities and for statewide agencies, developing communities in a better and better planned fashion is really all the planning community is about, including the consultancy as well. I'd helped work on a Oregon land use compatibility plan for the Oregon Airport Division and Eugene Airport Master Plan, both projects to help grow those needed infrastructures for communities across the state. For hospitals, like the one I work for now, Peace Health is working on a 170-acre project for a new regional hospital and a variety of different supporting complementary uses in residential development. For parks, for schools across the state, for the University of Oregon, and the expansion of the Arts and Stadium, for employment centers in Bonita and in Central Eugene in former brownfield sites that were reclaimed. But one project that I didn't work for is one of the best examples, really, I think, that the consultancies actually probably had a tangential relationship with, and that's the West Eugene Wetlands Plan, a project that land use planning was able to incorporate and take advantage of, incorporating the elements of wetland protection in some areas and preservation of needed industrial lands in other areas. Has become a vaunted award-winning program that's been emulated around the state and around the country. So it's just to give you a flavor for really, I think, land use planners are somewhat interlocutors, as Bob mentioned, about serving as facilitators for a wide range of allied professionals to develop a project and bring it to fruition, and to do so not only for the benefit of our clients, but also for the community at large. As Oregon APA represents a very broad constituency of planners, not only in the public sector, but private land use planners and those with nonprofit agencies, be they housing providers or other types of other type of groups such as port authorities and so forth, It's a very broad community, and we don't all speak with one voice, but it's a great opportunity for us to be able to serve as a resource to you and the communities at large that we serve for the improvement of the entire statewide planning program. So I'm going to turn it over to Reeve Hinging now, who's going to talk a little bit about OAPA's program relative to the planning commissioners and some of the projects that he's seen in his part of the state.
Thank you, Philip. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Reeve Hinging. I'm chairman of the Jackson County Planning Commission in Medford. I've been on the Planning Commission for about 8 years. I've also been on the board of OAPA for a number of years, and I was one of the authors of the report that Bob spoke of, which we call the COPE report, which you will be reading the executive summary of. Before I start, I'd just like to speak to Vice Chair Anderson. I had the privilege of serving under his leadership on the Rogue Valley Area Commission on Transportation, which he was co-chairman of until he was elected to the legislature, so it's nice to see you again. I'm here to talk about planning commissioners, and many of them are also members of OAPA. Some of you may have been planning commissioners at one time or another. First of all, we're volunteers. We're not professionals, so we're differentiated a little bit from the other two speakers that you've already heard. We're appointed by our city councils or board of commissioners, and we're unpaid. I like to think that we're representative of the community. We're citizens who were appointed to the commission to represent various interests in the community at large. Our role is to look at planning issues in depth. We make recommendations to our city councils and boards of commissioners. They don't have the time to look at these issues and spend a lot of time with them. So the role of the Planning Commission is to really try and come up with a recommendation that will be something that they can embrace and approve and put into operation. Planning commissions work mostly on long-range planning, looking ahead, the kinds of things that both Bob and Philip have spoken to. Each city and county, as you know, has a comprehensive plan, a long-range look at where we want to be some years down the road. And that really, I think, is where the Planning Commission, being members of the community, can bring an important resource to this process. We're citizens. We're looking for more citizen involvement from our other community members. But basically, we bring a number of different points of view to where we want our communities to be in some years. At the Jackson County Planning Commission, we feel that the comprehensive planning area is the time when citizens need to get involved. That's when they need to be a part of the process in determining the policies that are going to be in place for a number of years. When you look at it that way, by the time a particular application comes before a planning commission or a city council, it's really too late unless there's something that's really wrong with that application. Presumably, an application will adhere to the policies and the comprehensive plan and the land development ordinance that derives from that. So it's really important for people to sit down early on in the process and figure out just what they want their community to be. Let me just talk for a moment about the makeup of the Planning Commission. And I'll use as the example my own planning commission. We have five members, which is probably fewer than many planning commissions have, but we find out that we do plenty of talking before we make a recommendation with only five of us there. If there were seven or nine, Lord knows how long it would take us to make a decision. Anyway, the five members, one is a developer. Another is a farmer. We have a landscape designer, an attorney who does not deal with land use issues, and myself, who is a member of the Medford business community and a resident of the rural Applegate Valley west of Jacksonville. The five of us all bring, obviously, very different points of view, and it's with that purpose in mind that we were appointed by the Board of Commissioners to try and study each issue from as many points of view as possible, so that when our recommendation goes to them, we will hopefully have anticipated most of the public feeling, either in support or opposed, so that at least they will have that before them when they start considering the recommendations we make. I'd like to just speak for a moment on what our Planning Commission is doing about Measure 37. We hope that you in the legislature will do something to resolve the issues around Measure 37 and come up with clarifications of the many vague parts of that. But if you don't, we're already working on a way to incorporate Measure 37 into our county land development ordinance, which basically would go to the underlying issue of fairness. And I think that's what Measure 37 was all about. It was people just felt that in some ways the land use laws in this state were not fair. We don't know whether we're going to succeed in coming up with something that will be acceptable, but we're at least trying to find a way to ease the Measure 30 claims process by bringing it into the regular process of applications and allowing people what Measure 37 feels is the fair use of their land. In Jackson County, we have a process going on that is or is not, we're never really sure, part of the regional problem-solving process in the state. We've been working on it for a number of years, which is really a master growth plan over 50 years, the next 50 years for the Rogue Valley from Eagle Point down to Ashland. What this would do is we are trying to specify areas where we want the county to grow, and looking forward that far, to reserve these areas for residential, commercial, and industrial applications, to try and maintain the kind of jobs and housing balance so that people don't have to drive a long way to work. All these kinds of issues we're working on, and we're working on that quite a bit, and obviously the planning professionals in our communities are playing a very important role in making recommendations to the Policy Commission Committee, which is made up of elected officials. In the county, we're planning for White City, which is a large unincorporated area that's about 12,000 population now. It's the industrial area of the incorporated part of Jackson County, and we're working on upgrading the housing, bringing in more of our growing population in that area, once again for jobs, housing balance, and bringing in industry there. We hope that White City eventually will incorporate, and we're encouraging the residents of White City to think about that and work toward that end. One thing that our Planning Commission has been working on very specifically is with each city and its urban growth boundary, there is an urban growth management agreement between the city and county on how that area within the UGB but outside the city limits will be administered. Still part of the county, but it's the growth for the city. We've been talking to the city of Medford about a different way of administering it, and it has caused some problems for some of our large employers, namely Boise Cascade and Harry and David, both of which have large operations located within the UGB. And what we have been doing, in fact, another county planning commissioner and I, we have been meeting with both of those organizations, both of those companies, to try and overcome their concerns about these plans changes, because we think that they will be very helpful to everybody in the future. So there are planning and development things that are going on in each local community, and to a great extent, they're the result of planning that has happened in the past. One of the things we've seen in the past month is the announcement that Google is going to the Dalles. And the reason they're going there is because of the long-term planning effort that the Community Development Department and the City Council and various organizations there brought to bear on it. It's a combination of urban renewal, their long-range planning, and creation of an enterprise zone. And that's 50 to 100 jobs, which is a big deal in the Dalles, and that's the first phase. There are similar things going on in other parts of the state. In Bend, Bend's booming now. They're planning for further industry, further job creation by their long-range planning around a master plan for the Bend Airport and the Juniper Ridge addition to the UGB, which will provide a lot more industrial land for them. In Brookings, there's a lot going on there residentially, both at the north and the south ends of town, and so the long-range plans are working there to do those as well. I've just got about 2 more minutes. First of all, I'd just like to speak briefly to what planners can do and what they can't do. They can advise on where industrial and commercial land should be located, where it makes sense from a growth perspective, from an infrastructure perspective. But they can't actually provide those infrastructures and services. That's up to other people. They can provide advice on where a new school should be located given the growth patterns of the community, but they don't have any say in when that school will actually be built or what kind of education the kids will get when they go there. But planners can help plan a community or county to provide a quality of life that makes people want to live there. It attracts people and businesses, it raises property values and thus tax revenues. It makes it a vibrant community. I'd like to just talk about my experience very briefly as a small businessman in Medford. I moved to Medford 20 years ago from the San Francisco Bay Area and went to work for a company in Medford. About a year later, I had an opportunity to start a new business with an old friend of mine from San Francisco. We started from scratch. We went to 25 employees. I sold that business. My partner had since died. I started another business that added another 30 jobs in Medford. When we started, we had to decide. He was living in the Bay Area. I was living in Medford. I said, I'm not moving back to the Bay Area. I like Medford too much. I want to stay here. So either you move to Medford or we do it by long distance. He moved to Medford. There were no financial incentives available to us. Nonetheless, we stayed in Medford. We financed this company ourselves at the beginning. There were no public incentives, financial incentives for a small business, just a couple of guys starting out. Private incentives, bank loans, you know what they say about banks, they only loan to people who don't need the money. Well, That seemed to be the case in our the case in our case. We had trouble over the years finding appropriate buildings for our business. It's a hard thing to do in Medford, and yet we couldn't get the financing to build our own building. There was no trained workforce. We had to train them ourselves. Airline connections. Most of our business was outside of Oregon. Medford is not the place to locate if you're looking for easy travel back and forth. Nonetheless, we stayed in Medford. Why did we do it? Quality of life. It's a neat place to live. We wanted our families to be there. So there's a lot to be said about the whole planning process that creates the kind of communities that we want to see in Oregon. Thank you.
Any questions of this panel? Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Hender?
Hender. I was intrigued with your description of the White City circumstance, and I'm not sure exactly if it's right, but your association has issued a floor letter against a bill that would allow industrial and commercial development on areas zoned for industrial and commercial development, but outside of city limits. And I wonder how your process of issuing a floor letter against that links with the kind of, if it is at all relevant to the question of the development that you hope is going in that might eventually develop a city.
The White City currently, is an urban unincorporated community under state law. So it has a boundary line around it, and within that boundary line is where this industrial development and also the residential development. So it's not just a sprawling rural area. It's been identified under the rural communities portion of state law, and we've worked with DLCD over the years in creating this. So what's happening in White City, it's neither fish nor fowl, it's neither rural nor urban, but it has been created as a special case.
Sure, Representative Green, I think, and the other part of that answer is what the bill would allow is not just development within confined areas, but wherever. And taking what is essentially had been determined to be rural areas and allowing urban development in rural areas. And we, if you guys want to talk more about that, you may, but that was our concern.
It's area zoned industrial and area is currently zoned commercial. I mean, it's hard to think of something zoned industrial as a rural use. That's why I'm a little confused with that bill and by your floor letter against it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, you guys jump in anytime you want to, but let me take a stab at it. Before land use planning came to Oregon, there was a lot of development and some zoning in places that we probably wouldn't either do the development or the zoning today. We didn't get to start from scratch in 1973 and say, all right, we had a clean slate. We got a state where nobody's living right now, and we're going to start deciding where people are going to live, and we're going to start deciding where people are going to work. That didn't happen. We had to deal with the situation we found on the ground. So some of those places where there happened to be a mom-and-pop grocery store at a country road, for example, we're not going to say, you got to move. All right, that's going to be zoned rural commercial. Now, a mom-and-pop grocery store on a country road is not a huge place to sell automobiles, for example, where you've got square miles of lot and a huge facility, and you're inviting people to come in from 20 miles away to come buy their cars. They're two different, distinct kind of operations. One is a rural development, one is an urban development. All the law says today is that in rural areas, even if it's commercial or industrial, the level of development that was allowed is going to be in rural to rural standards. Now, the way it has been interpreted by LCDC is that there will be a size limit.
that you, we're a meeting we got chewed out the other day by your chair, as you may recall, for saying why we're moving faster. We just had a meeting last week of the task force that's working on this issue. Is the size limitation by square footage the best determination, best determinant of what is rural and what is urban use in these areas? And we haven't come up with an answer for that yet. We're working on it. But that's the answer there is today. And the reason why we say our organization opposed the bill is we don't think that urban development in rural areas, even if it's zoned industrial, if somebody had a little tiny up there where they were doing a little machine shop, for example, we don't think that's an excuse where you should just build a 10,000 square foot foundry. If you had, especially with, a lot of times you'd have a little machine shop that was working for fixing farm implements. People would come in and they got their hose were broken and tractors were broken. That's a rural use. So taking care of people in that community for their industrial needs or their commercial needs. But if you take something and say, we're going to set a big factory up here and we're going to have people drive 20 miles away or 10 miles away from their homes to come work there, then that's a different kind of use than we think is. I mean, we have to have, you have all these things that these guys will talk about road infrastructure and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Steve, what you're saying now runs contrary to what Don Schellenberg was just saying. When we talk about the $80,000 rule, he's saying that what your neighbors are doing is very important. What you just said is that even if I've got a small shop, that doesn't mean anything as to determining what may also be located in that same zoned area.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I'm saying that.
That's the impression I'm getting. You said if there was a small machine shop,
yeah,
that would necessarily open the door to a larger company located in the same area.
What I'm saying is there, if they're a small machine shop and the purpose of that machine shop was to take care of the rural community to fix their tractors and stuff, and it's already been zoned that way and it's going that way, then that's the way it is. What we're saying is that's the way it ought to continue to be. And if somebody wants to take that rural implement shop and change it to be a grocery store that serves people coming in that general area, they're seeing farmers are coming in the grocery store, that's still the rural use for that. But if you're going to expand the size of that and make it into a huge factory because the land's cheap out there in the countryside, then what you're doing is you're having an urban development, not a rural development, and you're encouraging people to travel long distances to do something that they probably ought to be doing inside the city. People ought not to be going 100 miles out of the Dalles to go to Google. They ought to be working inside the Dalles at the Google shop. That's what I'm saying. Is that not clear?
No, that's clear. It just becomes more argumentative than ever. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'd like to respond to that, Steve. It seems to me, and I think Reeves was pointing out, that sometimes businesses grow. A garage can become an apple, and it doesn't happen overnight. But I think we've got to provide the flexibility so that the small welder who's fixing farm implements now may become a small manufacturer and then become a moderate manufacturer and maybe even become a bigger one. And it seems to me, and we've seen this in the Medford and Grants Pass area, that it's kind of beneficial to see nodular growth become a node where people that are in the area go to that area and work. They don't have to go from Medford to Grants Pass or from Grants Pass to Medford, but they can work right where they are. Cave Junction can grow up somewhat. Some of the small businesses can grow and stay in Cave Junction rather than having to move to Grants Pass and then move to Medford as they become bigger. It just seems to me we need to be encouraging that small modular growth in nodules.
I'd just like to comment, Chair, and Mr. Vice Chair. I think that's exactly what the chapter would promote, in fact, is that very type of activity. And whether it's in Hermiston or in Cave Junction or even in Springfield, that we can grow those hometown industries and attract new industries to those locations. I think the only point that the chapter's been trying to make is actually to match the appropriateness of the type of industry with the infrastructure that's needed to serve it. And insofar as, there could be historic rural-related industries in Cottage Grove or in other, outside of Cottage Grove and at certain areas that serve the timber industry or the mining industry, that still have to take an urban use, though, and allow it to go out in that ex-urban area and siphon off some of that job employment that would go to Cottage Grove or to Springfield, and otherwise to pull those urban services out, and it would be much more expensive to serve that kind of a use out there than it would be more efficiently and more economically for the greater good of the taxpayers in a more centralized location. That's really the point that the chapter's been trying to make, insofar as some points on scale and the provisions that were in the prior legislation about sunsetting that in terms of scale and size, that's, I think, what we're still hoping to continue for the near term.
I'll just follow that. The thing that got me on this was when we were in the Bay Area as well, 20 or 30 years ago, 40 years ago. What now is Apple and the number of computer and silicon type industries was apricot orchards. And it would probably, by the thinking that I think I heard you say, those businesses should have been moved to San Francisco or LA where the manufacturing was, and never allowed to occur in the Silicon Valley. Whereas it grew incrementally, and now it's a major industry. Same thing could happen in Junction, Hermiston.
I agree with you, and I think the key to it is the infrastructure needs of that company as it grows, and when it grows beyond the point that a rural location with septic and well water isn't going to do the job, I think that's the kind of time that a company needs to move into town for that hookup. And I think that as the companies that you cited in Silicon Valley found those needs, that the campuses they created were in locations where they did have access to the infrastructure. So, you know, Hewlett and Packard started in the garage, as did, you know, Steve Jobs and all, but yet as they grew, they recognized the need to have access to the kind of infrastructure that would help them grow. And that's really, I think, where we're drawing the line that we would like to see.
Yeah, and I agree. I do think that let me frame this the way let me come back to it. I just lost the thought.
Mr. Chair, if I understand, I think when we use the word rural and urban, I think somehow we're talking apples and oranges. Some people, when they say rural, what they mean is small town. And other people, when they say rural, they're thinking countryside. And when I say a plant ought not to be in a rural area, I'm not saying it shouldn't be in a small town. I'm saying it ought not to be at a country crossroads. And there's a difference. No, at Central Point ought to be having. That's where people ought to be, the places where there are already services. There can be urban services in a little part of the town. But there's still urban services by definition if there's sewer and if there's water, there's electricity and telephone service, those kind of things. That's urban services. It can happen in a community of 500 people. So that's my point. I said the difference between urban and rural is the level of services and not the size of the community or the fact that there is a community. So if you're trying to build something at a crossroads where the country store is and say, I want to build a Home Depot there, that's probably not a real good idea. And that's what I think the bill allows.
Yeah. Representative?
Thank you. Let me just follow that. I think we're beginning to see new technologies that would allow for the infrastructure to be adequate for some of those modern. I'm not saying a huge manufacturing facility in K Junction, although we have an 88,000-acre mill that's out there, planted right in the middle of nowhere. But with step technology, different ways we can deal with wastewater and get the water that's needed, it seems to me that it's reasonable that we can allow some growth at least. There, I'd agree.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to weigh in on this bill because I'm carrying this on the floor. There are no urban, there's no services being allowed to be connected under this bill. So you said you think. So I just wanted to clarify it. And also, it allows for local control. The local elected official can make that decision. And it doesn't change the zoning at all. So I just wanted to weigh in on that.
I'm okay.
Certainly. Well, that's always a matter of conjecture.
Well, what I was exploring is the question of, I guess, how you came to that political decision to put a floor letter out on this particular bill. And I understand, I guess I'm the only Democrat here. I'll be acting like a Democrat, but I'm going to try and avoid that at the moment. I understand how Thousand Friends comes out with a bill because they have a model. And the model is very important to them, and that's what they're doing. They have a vision of how the state could look. But you, I would assume, would be in favor of good planning, not in favor of a particular planning model. And the thing that puzzles me about the objection to this bill is it assumes somehow that the county commissioners didn't know what they were doing when they zoned something industrial or they zone it commercial, and they won't know what they're doing when they approve a building permit to go with it. Now I would imagine that Weaver County Planning has maybe fewer professional planners than you have, but they ought to know what they're doing when they, if they were to approve something between Condon and Fossil, say, because they had its own commercial or they had its own industrial. So I mean, I was wondering why your issue isn't about the process the counties go through to get where they're trying to get in these buildings and in these projects, but automatically think because they're there and they're approved by the county and the project that would come along would have to be approved by somebody, that those folks don't know what they're doing in their own local area. That's what kind of puzzles me with the reaction to this bill.
Is there, Mr. Chair, Representative Green, Mike, as far as the process goes in terms of our evaluation of bills, we have a legislative policy advisory committee that has a listserv of about 35 to 40 members. So we usually send out an alert and ask for comment. And what we're doing in that process is asking that committee, we have a committee that's about 12 to 15 individuals with a chair and a vice chair. And so what we do is we ask advice from a larger group, and then we ask for a decision to be made by the smaller group as far as taking individual action. So that's how we operate in terms of our process. We're trying to get as much input as we can from our membership. I can't speak to all the specific merits of a particular bill other than as a planner who can tell you usually the size and scale, the ability to deliver urban services, and then who the development is being served are usually the criteria that we would use. And I think the feeling and the thinking was that here we might be opening up too big a Pandora's box in terms of not always expecting local government to be able to regulate for those particular impacts. The examples that I would use when I think of in terms of the city of Portland, we do a number of things that sometimes people wonder, so why haven't you removed the zoning in the central east side to allow for high-rise office development and other commercial activities? And part of the answer there is actually we have a lot of incubator industries there that operate, and when they do get bigger and they do grow, they can go to other industrial districts throughout the city. We have other areas that are zoned industrial where we have limitations. We allow very narrow kinds of activities that ordinarily you wouldn't think of that would be permitted in industrial areas, such as McDonald's, a motel, and a couple of other small facilities, because our criteria allow that if this person can demonstrate that they're serving the clients and the needs of the employers of that specific area, then we'll allow for them to be cited under specific conditions, what we call conditional use. So we may be into some gray areas and some very fine points of planning here, but I think it's largely a matter of scale.
You didn't finish the question about why we don't allow counties to make their decisions, why we feel that the value of the statewide plan with the regulations and rules that the counties make decisions within.
I think that essentially just goes back to the framework and the partnership between the state and local level, where that framework and that partnership says that here's generally what we want to have happen, and it's up to the local government.
But it's that attitude, sir, that got Measure 37. It's because of that position right there. We know best here in Portland and in Salem. And you local governments got to do everything how we tell you to do it within the framework of what we feel is good for you. That's what got you Measure 37, and it's going to get you Measure 38. Because you haven't listened to the people.
Yeah,
since
we got Measure
36. Yeah, well, 36. given Measure 37 and the forthcoming new annexation laws, if there is a victim in this, it's planners. Because it, in essence, is freezing you from doing any planning. Do you have any response to either of those two issues? Anyone? By the way, I think this topic is, of all the things this committee should be involved in, this is one of the big issues that we should be discussing and talking about in the state, because planning is what's getting changed right now, big time. At least that's my opinion.
Representative, Mr. Chairman Garrard, we realize this is a very big issue. We've seen quite a number of bills, and we recognize that it's an extremely important debate. It's a debate that's happening in the Portland metropolitan area. We know it very well. I participated in a May symposium that was sponsored by the Metro Regional Government, where we had representation from counties and cities that talked about the issues. We agree it's very difficult. We agree that citizen participation should be part of that process. I think where the rub comes in for planners and decision makers is whether we go to a direct democracy, what I guess I would call a direct democracy model of having people vote on every single annexation, or whether we have stepped back from that and have a different kind of model that allows for public participation, but not the direct democracy model. I think from a planning perspective, we're very afraid of that model because of blocking future decisions that need to get made for the broader community at large. We can speak to, I guess, individual bills and specifics of those bills. So maybe we do need to call time out and take a comprehensive look.
Well, I just get the feeling you're not listening. Your board's not listening to the people and what you see happening around you. And I apologize if I'm wrong. But when I hear you speak, it's all the things that are making people mad today are what you're sitting there defending. And I don't understand why you haven't heard that the people don't want these things.
Here's the issue, and I was trying to raise it in terms of your floor letter. It seems to me the job of planners is to create a vision, is to do the work that moves us towards a vision, but that vision has to be a vision somebody else has created. And the sense is,
is good planning the planning that creates a vision the planners have and generate, or is good planning relating to whatever the vision is that the people want, and either as a representative or as a direct democracy?
I hope you wouldn't be pointing at Portland and Salem. It wasn't planners from Portland and Salem who wrote Senate Bill 100, and it wasn't planners from Portland and Salem who decided what the structure of the guidelines and the rules were. Those were done by a process of outreach all across the state. And what the planning we're talking about now is planning that fits into the vision that was set up by other people. We didn't set up the goals. In fact, the legislature approved the goals, but that's people from all over the state. The planning that we're trying to do is not the planning that we come up with as planners. The planning that we're trying to do is say, let's take a look at what the goals are and how do we meet those goals. What planning processes reach those goals. You're absolutely correct. It's not the planner should be deciding what the vision is and then how to get there both. That's not our role. But there was a group of citizens who decided what that vision was, and Senate Bill 82, which is going to be coming your way fairly shortly, we're going to do that all over again. Because maybe 30 years, people's vision has changed what they want to have. And so we should be going out and asking, what is the vision that we ought to be going towards? Not asking us, asking the folks.
If I may just interject something here. In the report that's been mentioned today, the COPE report, the number one recommendation was for a review of the whole statewide land use program. So we very strongly support Senate Bill 82. We think it's really important at this stage of the game, and Measure 37, as you say, has emphasized that we step back and take a look at what the goals are, what the statutes and regulations are, and see if we're still headed in the direction that the people of Oregon want to go. Another recommendation of that COPE report was for citizen participation. We feel very strongly that citizens should be involved. They drive this process. I mean, why are we doing it? We're doing it because we want Oregon to be the kind of place we want to live in. What is that kind of place? That's what we need to take a look at again right now. Another recommendation of that COPE report was to address the issue of fairness in the state land use planning system. Measure 37, as I spoke to earlier, we feel has addressed that underlying issue. And as I said about what we're trying to do in Jackson County, is incorporate, use Measure 37 as an opportunity. You know, it may not be the answer, but it's an opportunity to find an answer, and we hope that the legislature will be the leaders in doing that. To somehow get at this gut feeling that so many people have that the land use system in Oregon is not fair to property owners. Whether we'll accomplish that, I don't know. But OAPA, since the report came out 3 years ago, has been in favor of these three things and some others. They've been in favor of more addressing more regional issues, not the one-size-fits-all. That's going to the issue of local control. It's all there. It's all recommendations, but currently we're operating under a specific system of land use planning and regulation, and planners, and certainly public planners, are sworn to uphold the law, and so it's very difficult to address some of these issues without bringing in the public to really address the vision and whether we're up now on the right track.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
I just might add to that. Thank you for that testimony. over a million people voted for Measure 37. That's pretty good citizen involvement. Thank you.
Any further questions? Gentlemen, thank you. Planning is something that, again, we are so much involved in affecting it that, Steve, it was very helpful for you to bring these gentlemen here to educate us in regards to what we're doing to you. I'm quite sure that this will be a somewhat tumultuous time the upcoming months in Oregon for planners. I truly see you as one of the victims of all this that's going on, and not quite sure you really deserve it, but
not quite sure.
Thank you very much. We will adjourn the House Committee on Land Use.